Hello, everyone. Welcome to NHL Induction Class. I'm John Shannon. Conversations with the latest honorees and inductees to the Hockey Hall of Fame. Our guest today, Frank Brown, the recipient of the Elmer Ferguson Award for writing in and around the National Hockey League. Frank, hello and congratulations.
Thanks so much, John. And I am as deeply touched and humbled today as I was when I was advised that the PHWA had conferred this great honor on me. So I'm thrilled to be with you and deeply touched to be participating in the induction.
Well, by the way, it's my favorite, one of my favorite weeks of the year, simply because those of us that are lifers have been around the game as long as you and I have. We get together, we get to see our friends, we get to see people that have been in the game as long as we have, some of them. It's kind of like the draft. Yeah. It's a time of friendship and a very exciting time. But you know that what jumps to mind to me, and I'm an old codger like you, Elmer Ferguson wasn't a player. You're a hockey historian. What does Elmer Ferguson mean to you?
I spent so much time at so many previous media honor Hall of Fame luncheons, John, and so many times I sat and wondered, why is this award named for Elmer Ferguson when really there are so many real legendary hockey writing names across the decades and the ages? And what happened when I was honored with this award was it really triggered my curiosity and set me off on a research project in search of Elmer Ferguson. I really was eager to find out more about someone who, to this point, had been really just a likeness and maybe 125 or 130 words on a piece of 12 by 12 plate glass in the vault at the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. And what happened in my research is he became more and more fascinating to me. And he was literally considered the dean of Canadian sports writers for his time. When he retired as sports editor of the Montreal Herald, he was honored with a banquet that drew more celebrities and more big name people and a larger crowd, actually, of somewhere between 850 and 1,000 people who paid a whopping $10 a plate for this dinner in 1957, and it was called in the next day's Gazette, Montreal Gazette, the greatest aggregation of national and international sports personalities, basically in the history of Canada. Mm-hmm. And of course, the fascinating thing about it was that this banquet for Elmer was conducted at the Windsor Hotel. Okay, and of course, the Windsor Hotel is the birthplace of the National Hockey League in 1917, and Elmer was one of the only reporter at the time who actually covered the board of the meeting that day that announced the birth of the NHL.
Right, his time as a writer actually predated the league by 3 or 4 years, didn't it?
No question. I mean, he actually one of the facts that I was chasing was I read an article that claimed that he actually attended the Montreal Canadiens' first game.
Wow.
At Jubilee Rink with natural ice in 1910, I want to say January 5th, 1910.
To be exact, actually, to be exact, yeah.
I couldn't find any supportive evidence of that. But what I did learn, okay, was that the thing that fascinated me was that Elmer, due to two accidents, lost the use of his left hand and his left arm. So his fingers were, the fingers on his left hand were clenched into not quite a fist, but he wasn't able to cause them to function. Mm-hmm. And what makes this fascinating is the Hall of Fame has one of his typewriters. It's a Smith Corona Sterling model, impossibly heavy, and really pretty difficult to operate when most of the time you're basically going to be typing with your right index finger.
Right.
Okay. The carriage return is.
By the way,
left.
that's the way I type now. So.
Well, it's funny because most of the time we type with our thumbs. I mean, that's really the way things are in this age. Mm-hmm. But when you imagine that. You know, the carriage return is on the left, the backspace is on the left, and the shift lock is on the left. It really, when you're typing with one hand, it's so difficult. So what I did was I found a Smith Corona Sterling on eBay.
You did not. You did not.
I did. Oh. I did. It's sitting right here in my office an image of the exhibit that the Hall of Fame provided of Elmer's actual typewriter. And I tried to, you know, change the paper one-handed. I had a copy of one of his old columns, and I tried to type it with one hand, and I gave up after about, I don't know, 10 minutes of exasperation. So, you know, the fascinating thing about it is it, trying to walk a mile in his shoes something that really connected me with him, mm-hmm. With the time in which he worked,
sure.
And gave me a fuller sense of awe relative to him, relative to being honored with the award that's named for him, and it gave me a chance to reflect on the profound nature of it because of the following: when Elmer was born. In 1885, Canada was barely
18 years
17
old.
Years.
Yeah.
It was barely 17 years old, actually. Mm-hmm. He was born in February of 85, and Confederation was July of 67. So it was Canada was so early in its post Confederation history. Lord Stanley was still overseas. He hadn't even been posted yet to become Governor General of Canada. And so that obviously means that, you know, the trophy that he decided to donate, was some, you know, 7 years, away.
Right.
And so the result of all of this is to connect with Elmer Ferguson on this level creates a profound connection with the history of Canada, the history of our sport, and the history of Canadian and of course American sports journalism.
Sure.
You know, in a very, very deep way. It's really remarkable.
By the way, you've sent about half of our audience to Google to wonder what carriage return is. They're going to have to find out. You talked about Elmer Ferguson in the first Montreal game, first Canadiens game.
Yep.
Your memory of your first National Hockey League game, even as a fan.
I'll go back to the moment, okay, as opposed to the date, because I have absolutely no recollection of the specific date. But I know that my friend, my schoolmate, Richard Hockenberg, introduced me to the game in 1965. I ended up going to Madison Square Garden, which at the time was located on 8th Avenue between 49th and 50th Street, as opposed to the its current incarnation. And I just remember the first time I saw the ice, the first time I heard the pucks slapping off of the boards and actually off of wooden sticks, which many of today's players wouldn't have much of a connection to. But the speed, the action, the color, just combined to captivate me and literally pierce my heart in a way that I can barely express.
Did you automatically become a Ranger fan then?
Well, again, because it was 1965, there weren't too many other options, and there was absolutely no exposure to any of the other five teams, you know, through which, you know, one could make a, you know, a real emotional connection. I mean, you know, if you're in New York, the Bruins are a lifetime away. The Maple Leafs are...
Fischler loved the Maple Leafs. He lived in New York and loved the Maple Leafs. What are you talking about?
Well, he figured it out. He figured it out, but it was not something that I was able to do. So, of course, I was a Ranger fan starting in 1965 when I was 13 years old, and that was basically, actually, it was literally the closest I thought I would ever come to the team would be was to going to be through fandom. And it just stuns me to imagine that not only would I end up writing about them, but I would cover the most momentous games in their modern history, including their Stanley Cup championship in 1994.
I hate to tell you, the only one in your lifetime, Frank. Hey, before we get to all that, in 65, you're 13 years old. Who's your favorite player?
Jacques Plante ended up becoming my favorite player. I always loved the goalies. I always loved the equipment. I always loved the appearance and the position of responsibility that they carried through. I was, you know, caught by the flash of the passing and the artistry of the forwards and things of that nature, but I've always gravitated toward the defensive end of things and the last line of defense.
So is that Phil Watson, the coach?
No, I would say it was a little bit closer to the start of the Emil Francis tenure. When I started in 65, I really didn't, maybe Red Sullivan, but the coach didn't really register on me as much as some of the players.
Well, that's what should happen.
That's
the way it's supposed to be.
And truth be told, nobody ever pays to watch somebody coach.
Do not tell Mike Keenan or Mike Babcock that ever, please. Please? They're both my friends. I can say that. Truth be told, I grew up a Ranger fan too, and I was far from Madison Square Garden. I loved the sound of Madison Square Garden. I thought it was just an electric place, and I loved the fans. I loved the way they chanted, even in the old building and in the new building. So you and I certainly have something in common there. Let's fast forward a little bit. You have fallen in love with our game. You now have decided you want to be a journalist for some silly reason. When did that happen?
Here's what I can tell you about the connection. My father worked for NBC, the National Broadcasting Company, both really on the national network level. Mm-hmm. And so one of the perks at the time was his access to RCA products. And in the late 50s, that meant access to some of the very, very preliminary color televisions, the first color television.
Sure.
And I can tell you certainly that one autumn afternoon in 1959, I was watching the World Series between the Chicago White Sox and the Los Angeles Dodgers with two broadcasters, and I'm going to guess one of them was Vin Scully. Their faces superimposed over the incredibly beautiful green outfield at this World Series game. And if memory serves, it was actually at the LA Coliseum, the, sure, the you know, the Olympic venue, as opposed to the place where the Dodgers play now.
Where the Dodgers played first before they went to Chavez Ravine.
Exactly. So I want to say it was at the LA Coliseum, which was retrofit for baseball. In any event, I saw the two announcers speaking with that gorgeous green background in exotic Los Angeles before a remarkably important sporting event. And I said, I've got to do that. That's what I got to do. I got to do that somehow. Somehow I've got to make that my life. That's my driving force going forward. I was seven, John. I was 7 years old.
Fantastic.
And even though I felt that, and I feel it right now as I'm sitting here, just as passionately as I felt it that day so many years ago, I never imagined that it would come true. I just know that that was the moment when, the momentum began.
Mm-hmm.
So, sitting here at the moment, when I'm about to enter the Hall of Fame for journalism in sports and hockey is looking back to that seven-year-old kid. My head is, I'm just as bewildered now as I could be at any other time.
Do you remember your first byline about a hockey game?
I can tell you that my first professional byline was in the New York Rangers program in 1970, in October of 1970. And one of my acquaintances, I honestly think it was certainly either Stan Fischler or Hal Bach. I'm not sure which of them it was, but they were, covering the Rangers at the time. They connected me with the great and dearly missed John Halligan.
I'll second that for sure.
Who, of course, as PR director of the Rangers at the time, also edited the game program. He took a chance on me, assigned me a piece on Frank Pace, who was his trainer, and I've always been an equipment nerd, so this was right down my alley. And he paid me $50 for the story, and I thought it was all the money in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it appeared in the game program for roughly 3 to 4 games or something of that nature, and when I stared at my name in print, and then I stared at my name on that $50 paycheck, I basically swooned.
And you would have done it for free.
I think we all would have.
Sure.
But boy, we also love pay, and and that was just a remarkable experience.
When did you go on the beat for the Daily News?
Well, that wasn't until 1980. Actually, in the intervening years, in 1970, I was hired as a copy boy by the Associated Press.
Mm-hmm.
When I started with them in the summer of that year, I was just about to go into college, and I said, "Look, I'll be the gopher. I'll go for the burgers, and I'll fill the glue pots." And
Frank, people are going to Google again for glue pots. I mean, this is going to be a two-screen podcast, because all these things, they're going to have to go and wonder what the heck they are.
Walking time capsule. In any event, the management at the time said yes, because, of course, who expected any young person to last the 3 years, to invest the 3 years in really what was an amazing education, watching some of the greats in action and learning about what being a professional sports writer entailed. Mm-hmm. And one of the people actually with whom I worked in the earliest years at Associated Press was Ben Olin, who is one of the earliest Elmer Ferguson honorees.
The role of wire services in teaching people how to write and how our business, both in print and in video, has morphed in so many ways, but the amount of contributions that in the sports world, I guess in every level of journalism, that AP, UPI, Canadian Press here in Canada, have contributed to some of the great journalists, and really they were there for content. They weren't there to sell papers or to sell subscriptions.
No, and that's it's an important distinction today when in the age of social media and citizen reporters coming into play here and becoming factors. Mm-hmm. AP, Associated Press, was just the facts. Okay, there was no, particular editorial style other than the conveyance of information to more than 1,500 newspapers around the world. Who played? Who won? Who scored? Just the details, just the facts. And there were opportunities at times for not editorial necessarily analysis, although anything that became editorial analysis had to be slugged as such, unlike today, for reasons that would go way beyond this podcast timeline to discuss. But it was strictly the facts, and everything important had to be conveyed in the first paragraph, because in many instances, the newspapers who combined to use the AP service, there were many instances in which the first paragraph was the only paragraph they used.
Right.
So it was a tremendous education in terms of structuring a story, determining and prioritizing the essential details, and probably at least as interesting, in many instances, some of the greatest AP stories in history were dictated. Okay, there wasn't even time for the reporter on site to type the stories and hand them to someone who would transmit them by a telegraph. In many instances, the stories were dictated off the top of a reporter's head extemporaneously and shot into the news world.
Which, by the way, made good writers good broadcasters, because they learned to tell stories off the top of their head.
Yes, and I will certify to you that I depended on my AP experience countless times.
Sure.
In the course of my career.
Let's get past the wire services. Your first newspaper job in New York.
Let me back up the wagon just a bit, because it's a factor. When you're writing for AP, your work is on display in 1,500 newsrooms.
Sure.
And 1,500 sports editors will have the opportunity to evaluate your skill. And what ended up happening was in 1973, I became the AP's hockey writer. And of course, in 1980, I covered the miracle at Lake Placid. Shortly after that, I was in in the Spectrum in Philadelphia in the press room, waiting for a playoff game to start. And a fellow to me introduced himself as said, hi, I'm Buddy Martin. I'm the sports editor of the New York Daily News, and I'm going to hire you. I've already talked to your boss. Hmm. Well, I can tell you, John, that if I'd had coffee in my mouth, I likely would have spit it on his slacks because of my utter astonishment. There are so many instances in which you write for millions of people who you'll never meet, and you still think that the only person who will ever read anything that you write is your mother.
Right.
So to imagine that this person had not only read my copy, but actually found it good enough to want me to be on the staff of the what at the time was the largest circulation daily tabloid in New York was stunning.
Yeah. Hey, before you go too far, I want to ask you because Lake Placid is such an iconic moment in so many ways on so many different levels. It was for many people in the media as well. How much access did you get to Herbie?
Herbie and I struck up a fantastic relationship earlier.
We're talking about Herb Brooks, folks. Yeah, we're talking about Herb Brooks, yes. No, that's my fault.
Good job, host. one of the things that happens in the Olympic experience is the venues are required to conduct sort of dry runs of the events that are going to take place in the months in advance of the Olympics.
Sure.
So the Olympic hockey of 1980 was actually preceded. In, I want to say, December of 79 by a preliminary tournament in which the U.S. obviously was entered. And so I had extensive exposure to the genius of Herb and the vision of Herb starting at about around Christmas time. The U.S. team ended up beating Russia on the way to a victory in the prelims, and actually one of the players said at the time it would be great to come back here and win the medal again.
Yeah,
and truer words were never spoken.
Were you at the Garden the night that the Soviet Union beat the USA? What was it? I think 10-3.
It was 10-3.
Yeah,
and it could have been worse.
Yeah.
Not only was I at the Garden, but actually I flew to Lake Placid from the Garden with the U.S. team on a tiny plane, and it was remarkable how utterly thunderstruck the players were during that short trip up to Lake Placid over what had happened.
Might have been the best thing to happen to them, though.
Well, and I, Herb never said this, but I think it all played into a grand plan, as opposed to facing them for the first time. Okay, the first time under the lights of an important game on the Friday night. Okay, this had allowed them to just get a sense, the players to get a sense of exactly what they were about to face.
Yeah.
And while Herb had made sure that they were in the right condition from a physical standpoint, that they were able to play as well in the last 5 minutes of a period as they were in the first five, because those were periods of the period that he very, very much focused on, and the Russian team did as well. Aside from the physical conditioning, the mental awareness was really, really important.
Sure.
And the ability to say, well, we can skate with them, we just can't really compete with them based on what we did at the Garden and what it gave Herb an opportunity to do was really refine what needed to happen in order to get the performances that they needed as the tournament went along.
So we all know Al Michaels' famous line is, "Do you believe in miracles?" Do you remember what your first sentence of your column was, or your story was?
No, because I was so much in the moment, and it was so much there wasn't any time to reflect on it. And I have gone back and read it a number of times, but I can tell you that when I was covering the Rangers Stanley Cup in 1994, even in the last few minutes of play, uh-huh, as it looked like they were about to win the Stanley Cup for the first time in my lifetime, and actually the only time in my lifetime to this point, I wasn't sure what I was going to say until finally it came to me at last. At long, long last, the Rangers are champions.
To finish the Herb story, because I'm a diehard Herb Brooks fan. I work with Herb myself. He was a very complex person. What was it like when he came full circle with you and walked into the press room or into the press conference as coach of the Rangers?
It was a treat to know that I would really have a. It was a treat to think that the Rangers would finally get a coach who could really, really take them someplace. And listen, I should back up the wagon here. Fred Shiro was brilliant. Okay.
Oh, sure.
And he and Herb were similar in mindset, if not in execution. Okay. Fred, of course, was so focused on the intelligent things that the Russian game or the European game brought to the sport, was eager to bring it to the Rangers at the time when he was coach. And Herb, of course, took that and moved it even farther. So the fact that you could play a game without simply skating your lane, the left wing staying on the left wing, the center staying in the middle, and so forth, was fascinating, groundbreaking, and important for the game that we enjoy today.
Well, let's face it. I mean, Herb Brooks actually might, as great a coach as he was, might have been a more effective coach in 2019 than he was in 1985.
No question, and he spent a long time being incredibly frustrated by the reluctance of his fellow coaches to embrace a game that featured so much more skating, so much more creativity, so much more skill,
sure,
than the game against which he more or less rebelled. And I should say the style of play against which he more or less rebelled, because it didn't serve the athlete.
Right.
Okay. So he saw it long before it could become commonplace. But among the multitude of landmark changes that were the result of the U.S. victory at Lake Placid was a willingness to accept that maybe there is something to this dry land training. Maybe there is something to the hybridization of the game to combine the strongest assets,
sure,
of the North American game with the intellect and creativity of the European game.
Yeah. So your time on the beat for the Rangers was about 15 years. Is that fair?
I was at the news from 1980 to 1998.
Okay. So
and
on the Ranger beat, and by then Islanders and Devils were in town. So you were bouncing a little bit around, but more with the Rangers than anybody else.
I really bounced around in the 80s simply because the Islanders dynasty began in 1980, and of course I covered their first cup for Associated Press. Then by the time I was hired, I did an extensive amount of coverage on the Islander juggernaut that won so many consecutive playoff series and really was a landmark team for the New York area. And spent a lot of time with Al Arbor, spent a lot of time trying to give Brian Trottier credit for his greatness and being utterly just enraged by his refusal to help me get him the recognition that I thought he deserved.
Listen, that's a young guy from Rosetown, Saskatchewan. You're not going to do that from a guy from Rosetown, Saskatchewan. You know that.
Well, he was a tremendous player, and you know that was an unbelievable team that could play any style and succeed at it. If you wanted to play a tight checking game, they had no issue with it. If you wanted to play shootout, they had no issue with that. If you wanted to play tough, okay, then go say hello to Clark Gillies and Bob Nystrom and mm-hmm. Gary Howard and any number of others. And the genius of Al Arbor in pulling the strings and creating the dynamic that they created was truly a marvel. So while I was very much ingrained in the Rangers coverage and so forth, it was something of a golden age in New York hockey to have the Rangers striving to climb over that mountain in Long Island.
How much of the Islanders' success put pressure on the Rangers?
The Islanders' success really galvanized the reality that it had been so many decades since the Rangers last won the Stanley Cup, and it was absolutely a painful reminder. The Rangers didn't have to come to Nassau Coliseum to be reminded of the fact that it had been so long since they won.
Right.
Okay, but the fact that that Bill Torrey was able to create in fewer than 10 years the magic that had eluded the Rangers for decade after decade after decade, it was never lost on any Ranger player.
Mm-hmm.
Simply, of course, everybody wants to win. Okay, everybody wants to win every year, and there had always been some mitigating circumstance that made the ultimate triumph so illusory for the Rangers.
It does speak to volumes, though, that when you would go to a Islander-Ranger game at the Garden, or I guess even at the Coliseum, is that the 1940 chant would start in the warm-up, and then on the other side, somebody would start the whistle and the Pot Van Sucks. And of course, our friend Denny says he thinks they're saying Pot Van's Cups, but that's not true. So, but that was as good a rivalry as Toronto, Montreal, Calgary, Edmonton. That was as good a rivalry as you'd ever see.
Oh, absolutely. And I would throw in I would liken it to the pitch rivalry between Montreal and Quebec City, because that in terms of passion, in terms of real fan energy around each city beating the other was palpable, and it remains memorable to this moment.
Yeah. We are going to talk about your next career in a bit, but just a couple of you're not going into the Hall of Fame for being Gary's chief of staff. You're going in the Hall of Fame as a writer.
Exactly.
Favorite city? You can't pick New York?
I will bifurcate it to say Chicago in the U.S. and Montreal in Canada.
Yeah.
Now, that's strictly for hockey fan passion, I should say. For scenery, obviously, I would pick Vancouver.
Okay? You can't name all 30 or 31 cities.
No, Frank. No. But truly, it was a privilege to have covered a game in each of the original six buildings, and to attend a game in Montreal. The fascinating thing is that going back to Elmer Ferguson, he covered the first game mm-hmm. in the Forum. Mm-hmm. I covered the last game in the Forum. And
that was something.
It was something, and it was such an emotional experience to enter the Montreal Forum on a Canadiens game night. Mm-hmm. And we'll leave that separate and apart from the traditions that have carried over to Bell Center. Still much more different, much more intimate place, much more passionate connection to the time when everybody wore ties and overcoats, ties and sport coats to the games and smoked like fiends.
18 steps, I think it's from Atwater to the ice surface. 18 steps.
Yep, and there was always a certain place where you could stand out on the street, and if the curtain wasn't drawn, there was a chance
you could see the game.
You could peer in through the glass windows,
yeah.
and try to focus, you know, some 100 feet or so to the ice and see one of the Canadians skating during practice, and it was an electric experience just to be standing on the street in the rain, snow, or cold.
I'm with you.
To try to get a glimpse of one of the Canadians' greats.
I am with you. And you talk about that, and obviously with your love of the game and love of the history of the game, to walk through either building, the old one and the new one, and to be able to say, well, there is, in my time, as I started and you did, there's Rocket. And there's Béliveau and Dickie Moore. It was as hallowed a place as our game has ever created.
I can tell you a couple of things in response to that, John. The first of which is every time I've gone to the Hall of Fame and walked into or past the replica Canadiens dressing room, I marvel at the authenticity of its recreation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, of the room that I stood in and interviewed Dryden or Shutt or Cournoyer or any of the number of legends during the late 70s when their dynasty was in full blossom. It always gives me pause to remember a time when the joy of being in each other's company mm-hmm. kept the players there. The players would practice, and we would be admitted to the dressing room, and they would stay and talk as long as they wanted, because the era was such that they really just didn't want to leave the rink.
Well, and there was a level of equality too, Frank. We were making the same amount of money as they were.
Well, maybe you were.
Oh yeah, I was in television. You weren't. Okay, 1998. You get a phone call from people on Avenue of the Americas, and you decide to leave the newspaper world and go and work for the National Hockey League and work for Commissioner Gary Bettman. And some of your friends said, why did you go to the dark side?
Yeah. It was really a situation, John, in which I saw what was coming across the print media landscape. I wasn't comfortable with the direction that I felt the newspaper industry was going, and that's not necessarily, you know, the stories that were pursued or anything like that, as much as I saw a great era really reaching a crossroads.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't comfortable with the part of the crossroads that I saw the newspaper industry taking. I couldn't really envision spending more time, filing, social media pieces during the game. I had to watch the game. I mean, like I'm something of a throwback in that regard. I needed to pay attention,
mm-hmm.
okay? And I felt that there were a lot of ways in which my ability to cover the sport was being compromised. And so to set the backdrop, it was becoming clear to me that it was time for a change in my life. Mm-hmm. And it was becoming clear at the time at the NHL that they were looking for someone who had major market media experience, and the cycles ended up meshing very nicely. They were looking for somebody like me, and I was looking for an opportunity that they offered. Yep. So just a great opportunity for me, and a great piece of synergy in terms of what I was looking to do.
I guess for those, some of you don't know, to simplify it, Frank became chief of staff for the commissioner's office. Is that fair, Frank?
Well,
how would you describe it?
I handled a lot of
sorry.
I was in the communications department. I was hired as a vice president of media relations, and ultimately stepped into the area of commissioner communications and handling a lot of the commissioner's media interactions, his market visits, his addresses to chambers of commerce, and in many instances, the news conferences in various cities where he stood determined to preserve the life of the franchise in that city. Mm-hmm. I can remember standing at his side in Buffalo, in Pittsburgh, sure. and in a number of Canadian markets as well, mm-hmm. okay, where the first question of every news conference was, are we going to lose our team?
Right.
Yeah, and the commissioner resolutely, steadfastly said, the last resort is moving a franchise. The first and every resort prior to that is supporting every possible effort to keep a team where it is.
Yeah. What'd you learn from him?
I learned never to be outworked. Okay. The fascinating thing for which he doesn't get near enough credit is that he will outwork anybody who works for him. Okay. He will spend more time. He will devote more energy. He will multitask on a level that is just remarkable to me. As a writer, I would focus on one story, one subject, one thematic, and he would have 12 different essential, critical issues on his desk, and be able to drop one and pick up another without missing a beat. So number one is work ethic, and I always thought I had a really strong work ethic until I got the opportunity to watch Gary and work at work, and nobody's going to outwork him ever.
What did he learn from you?
There's a chance to breathe every once in a while. There's a chance to relax every once in a while. That not every opportunity require, not every interaction requires a necktie and a prepared set of remarks, mm-hmm. because he's a terrific speaker extemporaneously, and he's an incredibly intense man, and it's an important element in his makeup, and he's also behind the scenes very funny, very comfortable, and I just did what I could to bring that part of his life and the work part of his life into a little bit greater balance.
You still like writing?
I do, but it's kind of like when you're retired, it's kind of like taking your skates off. In other words, you get to wiggle your toes a little bit, after all that time, squished into a boot, And that's one of the things that I'm enjoying now.
We didn't touch on it earlier, but one of the things after you learned the game and loved the game at 13 and put your first story in the Ranger program at 18 is you actually became a goaltender and wore the stuff. Do you still play?
I don't, because one of the sad realities of age is when the catching hand goes, there really just is no point. Okay, I played at the time when goaltenders occasionally stood up to face a shot, and you know, that was just before Patrick Roy basically reduced goaltending to mathematics and percentages.
Well, actually, that was your pal Jacques Plante first, right? Let's face it, that was your pal Jacques Plante.
Well, then Patrick was 2.0.
Yes.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah, the king of angles. Jacques Plante, the king of angles. You know that as well as I do.
Oh, yeah.
So, and what are you doing now?
Now I'm doing a little bit of PR consulting, but I'm much more proud of you know, being present finally in the life of my family. I don't think it's a great secret that the lifestyle, the hockey lifestyle, whether you're writing about it or living it in the league, is it utterly consumes every moment. Mm-hmm. And finally, after years of my wife sitting across the dinner table, biding her time while I wrote a statement or a news release or something between bites of the dinner that she had prepared, or brought to my attention some news while I was on the road someplace that I really would have liked to have been home for. The ability to be present in my family's life now that we have wonderful grandchildren is a blessing that I intend to take advantage of.
Well, thank you for this. I look forward to seeing you on the 18th of November at the luncheon for you and Foster Hewitt Award winner Jim Hewson. The Elmer Ferguson Award by the PHWA given to you is well-deserved, and it's people like you in the game that keep a lot of us around the game. So thank you for this, and enjoy your time Hall of Fame weekend.
I do appreciate it, John. Thank you.
That's Frank Brown, writer, NHL executive, someone who contributed behind the scenes to the success of the National Hockey League, and this year's recipient of the Elmer Ferguson Award. Just a reminder to rate and review the podcast. Feedback is always appreciated. I'm John Shannon. Until next time, thanks for listening to NHL Induction Class.